Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host.
Broud.
He knows all about the introduction and what to do every single point. You don't have to explain a thing to him.
Nice.
Just because I can describe the intro doesn't mean I'll deliver it very well.
Don't burst my bubble. So it's been 286 episodes.
Welcome to Polycast, episode 286. I am David Brown, also known as Broud. And with us, we've got the Mian Team.
Hello, hello.
Mad Jin.
Goodbye, goodbye.
Makalua.
I require more coffee.
And Dan Q.
As the games turn.
The DLC anticipation thread has 183 pages based on my forum configuration. I usually stay out of these kinds of hype threads for the most part. So do you want to give me some guidance as to something interesting that's come up that you noted? Then maybe
no.
Clearly nothing.
No, it's just it's really acknowledgement that this thread exists and that it was created the day after the fourth DLC for Civ 6 came out.
Oh, of course.
And now we're at more than 3,600 replies and 250,000 views.
If you've been on the internet long enough, this is something you just know you're going to see.
Think of all the time that you've spent speculating on the next DLC when you could have been playing the current DLC and the game itself. Is that controversial enough? Will people actually reply to the thread for this episode on Civilization Fanatic Center?
Dan, you're really not good at being controversial. Not particularly.
Well, when you're not living up to your contractual obligations, what am I supposed to do?
If I'm not living up to it, you're screwed, because, man, I've created accidental troll threads with more controversy on different forums, just like posting regularly.
Well, yes, I mean, you posting full stop is controversial, that's a given, but...
Well, that's true, yes.
Dealing with Sumeria. We got Gilgi. Gilgabro. Every time you capture a barbat post, you get a tribal village reward. Yay. And you pay a half the usual gold cost to levy a city-state unit. Sure. Okay. Free stuff. Always good stuff. And if you beat up on the barbs, and you farm the barbs, you get lots more. So, sure. If you're playing on online speed, or slightly faster than normal, then it can be really useful to crank out your unique unit, the Warquart. And then run around and run over all those barbs and barb camps, because at least they'll be fast enough to go do it. They get no penalty against anti-cav units, and they ignore enemy zone of control. They're great. They're a heavy cav unit that you get to build right away.
Well, yeah, you get those war carts out right from the beginning. You find those tribal villages, and you find those barbarian outposts, and you clear them in both cases and get even more stuff. And even if you don't start in open terrain, because you get four movement, otherwise get a three-move unit right from the beginning, and all you had to do was either select the Civ or random into the Civ, and away you go. When Civilization VI was first released, I played this Civ way too much because I wanted an early rush. I didn't have to bring anything else with me either. It was just Warcart, Warcart, Warcart. I didn't need combined arms. Squish your face.
Yeah, strength 30 base before any stuff. So before versus barbs, before flanking, before all the other stuff. So you've got a unit that's give or take slightly worse than a sword, but better than most of the starting stuff to begin with.
Pretty solid. Drop cities pretty early on, too, before they start breaking strength.
Yep. As long as you hit them before they really start going. And actually, if you get them out fast enough, you can pick off a couple city-states if you want before they even get walls up. Though I find, like I mentioned earlier, on online speed, it's easier just because of the way that the math works out on all the speeding up and cost reductions. It only takes like 2 to 3 turns at most to build something on online speed, whereas if you were trying to build a Warcart first on standard speed, that 55 production cost will take you a while. Probably longer than you'd want if you're trying to pump out a bunch.
If you're trying to produce a bunch and you realize, gee, it would be nice to be able to buy some as well in between constructing them, did find all those tribal villages, right? And you captured all those barbarian outposts, right?
Well, you had to get out there first, right?
Which is very easy to do with a war cart right from the outset.
Otherwise, yeah, I mean, tribal villages can give some really nice stuff. And there's pretty much no wah-wah-wah sort of rewards. It's good stuff. Extra gold, faith, tech and civic boosts, which are nice, especially if you're not really focusing on getting those. Extra pop, extra scouts, extra builder. Yay. Lots of things that you can get to effectively replace the production time that you would have spent building those things.
And if anyone listening is thinking, oh, so I have to do this before my opponents get city walls, and then I guess I'm screwed then, right?
Well, yeah, that's what you get better maps for.
There's that, and there's also, oftentimes in cities, you're probably going to be able to hit the city more than once on the same turn. And if you've got all these war carts wandering around, which you've been able to produce and or purchase, and by the time they start getting walls, guess what? Your war carts probably have a promotion or two on top of them as well. So you just continue to smash. I think the one time I get disappointed with Sumeria is if I realize I'm on an island.
Well, that would just suck.
That bummer, yes.
It's not that I'm not going to produce war carts, but I'm probably going to realize, or hopefully I realize before I have, you know, 10 or more of them, that, I'm on an island. So, yeah, certainly you can send them out into the water and then land elsewhere and then start exploring very easily. And then you can definitely be taking someone else's tribal villages and barbarian outposts. And, yes, this, of course, assumes that you do not disable barbarians, admittedly,
or
disable tribal villages, obviously. I guess that would be the other time to be, quote-unquote, upset if you rolled Sumeria. But in and of itself, very, very good for an early rush strategy.
Yeah. So you also have your Ziggurat, which looks better than it acts. You've got two signs flat, plus one culture if an extra river, can't be built on hills, extra plus one culture after researching natural history. So you can drop some of these down, and if you need early science without building a campus, this would be good. Two sciences. Unless you have a really good campus location for adjacency bonuses, basically the same as a library, so just slap this down and then build the campus later.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing you're not getting from that, of course, is the great scientist points, but
yeah,
if you're trying to push yourself off a little boost early on.
Yeah, and if you happen to put it on river, at least initially, then you get your culture, so you can get through your civics to getting to oligarchy a little faster.
But if someone says, well, okay, I want to construct a ziggurat here, but it's going to be a really nice spot for my industrial zone later on, change it out later. It doesn't have to be permanent.
It's only a builder charge.
That's right.
Just obviously, given that there is a cost progression for every tech and civic that you get, makes everything else more expensive, including building districts, which is really idiotic. Just don't try and mass tech with ziggurats or other such things. You'll just make the actual districts too expensive eventually, and then bad things will happen.
Just use your probably encampments that you're building instead of the campuses to go take the enemy campuses and then do your research further.
Yeah, or you can just switch in and out of the ziggurat as needed. That's a nice thing about the sand tiles.
Then we slip back to Gilgabro. His unique leader ability is that he can declare war on anybody at war with their ally without warmongering penalty. So if your ally is Teddy and Teddy's at war with, I don't know, Scythia for giggles, then you can go declare war on Scythia, and people won't care as much. And of course, when at war with a common foe, they and their allies share pillage rewards and share combat experience gains if within 5 tiles. So effectively, walk around behind one of your allies and collect all the experience as they fight. There you go. Don't actually help. Just be in the neighborhood.
It also works with barb combat. So even if somebody beats you to the barb, you still get a little trickle of experience.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, you got a really injured war cart, and you're like, can you perhaps clear that for me ahead and take it, and then I'll just take the experience? Thanks, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the points made is that no warmonger penalty is only for the Dao. It's not what you do during the war.
Of course, it has to be only for the...
This is the ship that you usually see at its best early in the game, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, if there's a neighbor near you, regardless of who the neighbor is, you just kind of blindside them, and you can get to them more quickly, number one. And if you get to them more quickly, of course, earlier on in the game, it's very easy to have little to no warmongering penalty to begin with anyway, and then you can wipe them out before you really start having many kind of travel issues And before anyone else can even react or perhaps even know that you or the other Civ existed in the game, so you don't have to worry about other people warmongering hating you. It's great.
Gilgaro's AI agenda is the ally of Enkindu. Likes Civs who are willing to form long-term alliances, dislikes anyone denouncing or attacking his friends and allies. An addendum to that is a total dumbass. Willing to say nice things to you and then promptly declare war on you just because.
He's your frenemy.
Yep. If you can lock him into a declaration of friendship early in the game, then he'll be okay. Because you don't have to constantly repeat it. Because he'll like you for being friendly for long-term stuff. But if you don't get him locked into a friendship, no matter how much he likes you, he will declare war on you.
Just because.
Yeah, that's a worthwhile agenda. Although the part about dislikes anyone denouncing or attacking his friends or allies. Shouldn't that be any leader's agenda, really?
Yeah, pretty much. But he just doubly dislikes it.
Or some such.
Yep.
Whether he actually does anything about it, practically speaking, is another matter.
Yeah.
That goes for any AI, really.
If he's the AI and then I'll get a bro on you, just punch him in the face and walk away. He'll eventually get too weak to be able to do anything. Or just out-tech him to swords, and then you'll be fine against the stupid war carts. Or you can be really creepy and go straight to pikes. Pikes don't do anything to the war donkeys, but if he starts upgrading them into knights, well, you already have pikes. And pikes are stronger than the war donkeys.
Yeah, that's just all part of being aware who your neighbors are and what they're fielding and what the best or at least a better counter is to those units.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if you can, become frenzies with him. Particularly if you're not in a position to do something about him. As it were, getting him rid of him from the map, or I want to take care of you, get you off the map, but a little later. You can position yourself to have him look at somebody else first. Maybe send him a gift or two, if you feel like you need to.
Yeah.
If you feel like he's a particular threat.
Play nice with Gilgaro and then punk him later.
And so now in As and Against, we move on to the downloadable content, Civilizations for Civilization 6.
Yay! Australia! Oh, yes. Yeah, because we all saw me actually tweet about this and basically squee because Australia. Anyway, civility, land down under, plus 3 housing in your coastal cities. The pastures trigger a culture bomb. That's so much fun. The yields from your campuses, commercial hubs, holy sites, and theater squares all increase by 1 in tiles of charming appeal and plus 3 in breathtaking. They actually nerfed that. It used to be 2 and 4.
Yep. And plus 3 is still pretty solid.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the adjacency bonus. Gets that bump.
Uh-huh. But it's good. So good. Leader bonus for John Curtin. Citadel of Civilization. Plus 100% production if they've either received a declaration of war in the past 10 turns or if they've liberated a city in the past 20 turns. This is so great when the AI decides to declare war on you. Sure, declare war on me. Let me build troops even faster to come smash you in the face with.
Yeah.
Well, it's not even troops. It's just 100% production.
Oh, yeah, everything. Or thanks for accelerating my building of this wonder or my districts or whatever else I was working on top of it.
And all you have to do is liberate a city.
Yep, and considering how much the AI likes to pick on you if you're not attacking things fast enough for them. Like, oh, I hate your face. Nice of extra production. It's so good. This is why Australia is slightly overpowered and why they can pretty much do every victory condition.
That works on a city-state, too.
All the AIs like to run over the city-states, so just play Australia and go liberate.
Every 20 turns.
Every 20 turns. Liberate, liberate, liberate. You can liberate all your stuff. Leader agenda perpetually on guard. Forms defensive pacts with friends and likes civilizations that liberate cities. And he dislikes civilizations in a war that are occupying enemy cities.
Mm-hmm.
Just he's
kind of jerky about it.
Yeah, one of the many reasons why you don't mind playing Australia, but when they show up in the game, it's like, oh, God, you're going to be a pain in my rear, aren't you?
Until you punk him, because he sucks, but, you know, as the AI.
Yeah, I was going to say the player is much better at Australia.
The AI is not going to make good use of their adjacencies or outback stations compared to the player, and there's not a lot of early bonuses here for them to defend themselves, so.
Well, the plus 3 in breathtaking for the appeal side, if you choose the correct locations, you get your civics and your science up to make sure that you get all the nice
war bonuses. They're not doing that. They had to place districts well in general, even before having to account for yet another factor. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, without that, they're getting nothing early, really. They should be. Maybe if they settle a coastal city, they're getting some, but that's about it.
And the culture bomb from the pastures.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is to the AI, I guess.
Yeah. The problem is that the AI will wait till a pastoral place is
fully surrounded with culture and then built the pasture.
Right.
So and I'm sitting there buying tiles. Get me to that thing so I can culture bomb. It's worth it. And then you connect all that and all the desert next door with outback stations. Plus one food, plus one production, you know, half a house. And plus one food from every adjacent pasture. And with steam power, you get plus one production from every two adjacent outback stations. And then rapid deployment gets you plus one food, also again, from every two outback stations. So, yeah, you can even ramp them up even further if you'd like.
They're like Civ 4 workshops, and they scale similarly. It's ridiculous because Australia is the only one who gets them. They're pretty good.
Just cover deserts in outback stations.
Yes.
Don't even build anything else or anywhere else. Once you get to that point, just mass cover with a Petra, and there you go.
Sahara will become one massive outback station.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, sure, yeah, they can also be constructed on desert hills, grasslands, and plains tiles, and maybe, oh, well, there's lots of adjacent pastures here, but the focus is definitely on the desert, because unless you were thinking, oh, I guess I could put entertainment complex here, really, what else are you going to be doing with your deserts anyway?
Yeah.
It's worth the builder charges. It makes desert a useful, productive tile.
But it's not like it's bad on other tiles. Its adjacency bonuses make it ridiculous. You can just carpet with that.
Uh-huh. It's great.
Yeah, I'm just thinking versus farms, because eventually you get plus one with every other farm on
yeah,
top
farms
of
don't
the
give
base
the hammers.
Tile. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking
getting,
about like how much
one
than
two hammers pre-terrain just from the outback station.
No, I'm just thinking about how much food you actually lose if you wait and don't farm anything. I mean, obviously
you need
to farm for how tall can you grow, but Australia doesn't really need to grow tall. Especially if you're going to get all that extra production.
You're thinking, like, make the farms early to grow and then swap them out later, depending on your builder charge.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking early. I'm just thinking, like, okay, so a fully maxed out set of farms is plus one for each farm next to it. So how much food are you going to lose by outback station spam? Which is not very much.
No. Each of these outback stations is feeding the colonists working them, or in some cases, then some, if you're not on desert. So you're still going to grow pretty fast. Like
yeah.
That. And you get hammers to hammer out additional stuff if you need it.
Yeah, plus food is so plentiful in this game. I mean, you just don't need to be spamming farms, but it's really beneficial to spam outback stations.
All that production you're getting from the outback station going back to the, oh, have you been declared on by another civ? Oh. Have you liberated a city? Oh, so that makes your outback stations even better, as if that was necessary, which it was not, but we'll take it. And as you're growing as well, you have that, as long as you settle on the coast, you've already got that additional housing capacity. So if you're thinking, oh man, I need to be construct granary, I got to improve my housing. Well, you can certainly do that eventually, but you can be concentrating on other things, like a builder to then go out and construct outback stations.
Yeah, well, it's not until guilds, so there are times for you to go and build farms and other things first.
Yeah, you have to get there first.
But once you get to guilds, spam!
Spam. Yep, mass, builder spam to just run out and change everything over. Which also means, yeah, you might want to get the pyramids, and if you're near a desert, that should be possible.
So if you're continuing to continue that production train and you're not able to get people to declare war on you for whatever reason, and you're looking to liberate cities, particularly as you go along in the game, there's a unique unit of yours that can help with that.
Yeah, did you want a more powerful version of an infantry? Because that's what diggers are.
Significantly so at that.
Yeah, it starts off with just an extra 2 strength from the normal infantry, but then plus 10 combat strength on coastal tiles and plus 5 combat strength outside Australian territory.
With Australia, I think about domination, but I also think about space victory and how expensive it can be to construct all those parts, even the spaceport districts initially.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how come you're liberating cities? I'm at war with you. How come you're not trying to come into my territory? What are you doing? Oh, nothing. Don't worry about it. I'm just sitting back here enjoying the added production. Here, I'm going to come around and I'm going to denounce all of these civs in the hopes that one of you will declare war on me. Thanks. And possibly do other things as well to tick you off. You settle too close. Now my people settle where they want. But you might lose that city. Oh, that's okay. I've got all these cities back home that are constructing spaceports. Don't worry about it.
Yep. If you know that there's a civ out there, say Germany, that conquered a bunch of city-states, really, you just declare war on them, take the hit, and then just start liberating city-states. Because others will enjoy the fact that you liberated a city-state or a city anyways. So you can just take the hit and get that added production. for the
you can take that slow. You know, like about once every 20 turns, you can free up a city state. Yeah, you know, don't want to be too aggressive with it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you can stay at war as long as your war weariness doesn't hurt you, and as long as you're not actually taking other cities to have more war weariness.
Well, if you're actually taking other cities, you're probably not going for the space victory, or you're probably just going to go in, which is fine.
You can sit there and just force them to rebel by jacking up their war weariness.
Well, on to Macedon. Mace Don, lol.
Mace in the face.
Yeah, pretty much. All game long, without stop. this is one of those extra balanced DLC sets, like Australia, for example, only different. This one's a little more early game focused. Hellenic Fusion receives boosts upon city conquest, Eureka for encampments or campuses, and inspirations for holy sites or theater squares. So it's good to take cities, and now it is better to take cities. As for the leader himself, Alexander, no longer Butt-Chin, but if we are to remember our fine Civ 4 and 5 roots, it's still Butt-Chin. Yeah, cities do not incur war weariness. So all this talk about rebels and whatnot, not for Alex. Nope. All military units heal completely. Take a city that has a world wonder, and on the wiki, it says hidden, allows access to one of the better early unique units, but I'm not good at pronouncing this kind of stuff. The Tyroi, I guess. I don't know. It's a heavy cavalry in the place of a horseman that upgrades to knights, which is immediately very useful in that regard. And it gets extra 5 strength when you're a great general. So you get to stack great general stuff even more than you would normally stack great general stuff and just roll face with this thing. You also get more great general points killing stuff with it, but, I mean, hey. And then you upgrade them to knights and keep smashing stuff with your stacked great generals because, lol, that's balanced in this game. Macedon also has another early game unique unit, Hypaspist? Question mark. This one's also pretty good because it gets 5 combat strength when besieging districts and actually benefits from the unique building more readily. But I find it hard if you're playing Alex and not some alleged future controller of this Civ to build this over the horse unit, which is just freaking amazing. But it's there. It's there. And then the unique building is a building in your encampment, which you should be building to run these classical age units. And you just gain science equal to 25% of the unit's cost when a non-civilian unit is created in the city. So yeah, when you're spamming your units, you get science for it, but you then get even more science when you take cities. Yeah, so you should probably be trying to take cities with this Civ. This is a very, very domination-oriented Civ that is an extremely strong early game.
And have to make peace.
Yeah, and just can war all game long without exception. And drive up everyone else's war exhaustion by refusing to make peace because he feels no effect. About his agenda, short life of glory. Basically, if you're fighting anybody other than Alex, he likes you. And then if you're at peace, he dislikes you because screw you, you hippie.
Yes. That's about it.
Yeah, this is a really strong early rush ship that scales into like perma warfare really nicely.
I can't help but compare it a little bit in that respect to India. Of course, other civilizations suffer additional happiness penalties for warring against Gandhi.
Negated.
No, it's not negated, though. It's plus 100, minus 100.
Yep.
You will only gain war weariness versus Gandhi.
Nice. Nice touch.
I mean, it is a notable point, but I don't really think it's that big of an issue with Macedon, but it is worth noting how that works out humorously.
Oh, yeah, you do also get 50% support bonus on the sword. I didn't mention that, but it's there as well. It's a good unit. I would probably build it a lot if I didn't have access to the horse units, which are just ridiculous.
Get some battering rams,
get some horse units, stack as many classical age great generals as you can muster,
and then make more.
Start winning. Yeah. And then upgrade them to knights, clear your generals still apply, and now you have, like, 6-plus movement speed knights that will work into the industrial AR.
Yep. Get the free bombard really, really early so that it one-shots cities.
Oh, and yes, the unique building for Macedon replaces the barracks.
Right.
Possible as Macedon, as you're conquering, you might accidentally trigger a cultural victory if the cities you're taking over have lots of that infrastructure. That's not happened to me. It has, just not with Macedon. It is possible. But otherwise, yeah, just smash everything. episode 276 of Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian team, Majin, and T-Pangolin.
What was your initial reaction to Australia as an entry in the game? Because I've seen a lot of diverse opinions online. But the reason I made Australia in the first place was to prove that it could be legitimate.
You could make a sieve for every single nation on the planet, considering how legitimate.
No, this is the thing, though, because I kept them being pushed back originally in the pre-release of Brave New World. I kept them raising the issue of, hey, could Australia be a thing? And everyone's like, no, it's civilization, not nation state. Get back in your cage, you monkey. I'm not going to be told no. So I thought, okay, how is it possible to present something in which you could do something that normalizes Australia and gives Firaxis the justification that they need in order to consider Australia? So you push extremely hard for it and try to portray it in a legitimate light. And the other end goal to that, essentially, was so I could move on to make more sort of diverse, interesting indigenous cultures that people haven't heard of, but those wouldn't have ever been as popular if you didn't do Australia first, because those were normalized alongside Australia, which is now normalized alongside historical heavyweights. So it's a step-by-step process. I reckon, if you want diversity in the game.
No, I don't think this is a diversity game. I mean, people have complained quite a bit, but if they were going for the quote-unquote Civ heavyweights, then there's a long list of Civs that should have been in, like, just the base release, never mind the DLC, and others that should not have been in at all. Brazil?
Why Brazil, though? Is it just more of a citizen thing as a marketing thing, and therefore it's less worthy?
It's not really a Civ. I mean, at all.
It's fine.
Maybe the word we need to start using is it a unique culture?
Oh, no, God. No, we're not going there. Crap, no. Oh, no, those are fighting words. Holy crap.
I'll just duck out of this. It's different enough that I don't really care. I'm fine with it, personally.
Yeah, no. I mean, realistically, I don't care overall. They could make whatever they want. As long as it's fun to play, who cares? But there are the quote-unquote historical heavyweights, you know, those who actually had an impact on the world, regardless of what people feel about it. They had an impact on the world, and therefore it does not feel like a game of Civ if there is a lack of those Civs.
No, oh, yeah, absolutely.
To have Civ 6, they call it Eurofocus, which I think is just crap, but there's a few too many successor states or colonies right now, and not enough Civs that they were based on. So it's kind of like put all the colonies up front and then use expansions for all the good ones, hopefully.
That was my thought, is like, if you're going to release Australia as a DLC, that to me implies that you're going to include a lot more historical heavyweights in any sort of expansion, because if it was shoehorned into an expansion, you would think, oh, hang on, that means if Australia is included, that something else was omitted, because that was a really big thing, especially with Brave New World and Gods and Kings.
That's always the case.
Yeah.
They have exactly, well, however many Civs in their list for... For each Civ game. They have only so many that they can add. So, yeah, it's a limited set that's going to make it in. If I mean, you go, oh, well, this is an interesting culture, and this is where I get into bad arguments with people when they start talking about, well, we need more from this area of the world because they're interesting cultures and they should be considered this too. But they're like, okay, but what did they do for the 20,000 years of quote-unquote history? Nothing? Okay.
Ooh, those are fighting words. 20,000 years of nothing. Wow. Tell that to an indigenous person.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah.
20,000 years of nothing. No, seriously. I completely understand where you're coming from in terms of this is a game called Civilization where you do have historical heavyweights battling it out. But the thing is, with any Civilization game, there's always going to be your pandering marketing civs, like Australia and Brazil. There's always going to be your heavyweights, but there's also going to be your other diverse civs. So I'm interested to see that now Australia and Brazil are normalized, what other things can be normalized and what stories can be told on a level that usually wouldn't have this platform. Because I think that video games are a really, really interesting way to shape and change perceptions about how particular cultures are seen. So my focus on indigenous cultures. You say, okay, let's have a Native American civilization, and people would say, okay, Indians are just homogenous, but the thing is, so many different
Civs. That's not
true.
we had that a couple of Civs ago.
Oh my God. Native American. I mean, the thing is, you're dealing with an uncentralized culture. It's okay to blob to a certain extent. I do that all the time when creating civilizations, but the thing is, as long as they can share an identity that they are a unified culture in some sense, then I think it's somewhat justifiable. But
it has to be justifiable. You can't put the Salish and the Iroquois in one group and call them the same.
was pretty hilarious in this far.
Yeah.
And so is the Holy Roman Empire.
That too. Yeah, stuff like that's just bad.
Those two are great, quote unquote.
Yeah, I will be so disappointed if they ever release an Australian Aboriginal civilization that's literally just covers the entirety of Australia. Oh boy, that'd be heartbreaking.
Well, that's it for version wise at the US.
Native Americans, air quotes.
The Native American civilization. Yeah.
I knew that when we were going to start talking about Australia, that it was going to bring up this substantial, relevant side conversation. Let's just interject, first off, what Firaxis and 2K have said about why Australia is here, which, as far as I'm concerned, leaves much to read between the lines that we can't even begin to. The team is, quote, often asked how they get their ideas for civilizations in the game. The answer is they listen to the community. Congo was added to Civilization 6 as the most requested civ by the community at the end of Civilization 5, unquote. As a side, I would like to see your criteria for determining that. But okay, fine. For the sake of argument, let's accept that as true.
I specifically gamed the system in order to make Australia happen. That's the thing. Like, I knew that in order for Firaxis to actually pay attention, you need to game the system and get community support in order to get them to look in your direction. Because if you look at Australia as a very well-known name American, and so does the Congo, and when you see what Native American civilization you want to see, it's always going to be the Cherokee, it's always going to be the civs that everybody already knows. If you listed the Shoshone amongst them, people wouldn't go for it because they had no idea who the Shoshone were prior to Civ release. So it's interesting to think.
There's plenty of people who like that sort of thing. Keep in mind, this is being made by East Coast Americans, there is limited historical perspective on that front. When it comes to like things like, what is Australia? I know it's this, this, and this, because that's what we've been told in our culture.
Yeah, this is interesting. I was watching a couple of videos at Firaxicon. I decided I'm just trying to understand way more of the culture about Firaxis, and a couple of talks about just how they came to conclusions through the civ development process. Like, for example, Lena Brink was talking about the way that they source opinions online is the developers are constantly scouring forums. And Ed Beach even did something at the GDC where he constantly talked about how they scour the forums and how they try to find out what the underlying thought patterns of what everybody's doing. But also, Lena was talking about the fact that they use sources like the forums and also, you know, the Frankenstein testing group to ask people about specific cultures and specific people and specific elements of cultures, especially if they're from that location. So it feels like that's their criteria in terms of the amount of research that they're willing to do to go out of their way. They do a lot, but obviously there's a lot left to be desired, especially in a constantly changing world where people kind of need a bit more historicalness, I guess, or something a bit more clear as opposed to vague definitions and things that as if they're a kind of objective proof, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, 2K and Firaxis also said that Australia has been a consistent top pick by our fans and now appears in a Civilization game for the first time. I think just generally to me, when I see Australia here in Civilization 6, when I saw Brazil in particular being introduced in Civilization 5 through Brave New World, I'm thinking, okay, they're going beyond those kind of historical heavy hitters and looking at civilizations, and they're going to include in that criteria a nation state.
Yep.
So, okay, I'm willing to accept that, particularly when, order arguments notwithstanding, because we've already talked about that, when you look at the number of civilizations that were added to Civilization 5, I can kind of see them say, okay, maybe we need to extend our reach, because as much as we want to have interesting civilizations, we want to be able to have it rooted in some sort of historical base. Yes, we still want it to be interesting and relevant to the gameplay, but we want to be able to point to a specific group, and at a certain point, to get to the numbers that we want to in terms of adding civilizations, we're going to have to extend that out. I'm waiting for whenever they talk about specifically what were former British colonies, how they talked about Brazil got in as compared to, say, Canada or Australia the last time, which was an
18th. Oh, yeah. Pretty much every single civilization that they dismissed were the civilizations that I were working on. Their reasoning for including Brazil specifically was because they were hosting the World Cup.
Yes.
And also specifically because they were also hosting the Olympics. And if you notice, Firaxis is now, since Brave New World has, in every single release that they've done, whether it be Beyond Earth or Starships, and even with Civ 6, Brazil has been included as a base Civ. what I'm interested in is, are there people on the team that legitimately believe that Brazil should be a civilization, irregardless of if it is a World Cup thing? Because it almost seems that now that we're over the whole sort of Brazil is amazing because of the World Cup, it almost feels like the discourse surrounding Brazil, whether or not it should be in the game, is completely gone. Everybody's forgotten about it. And that from here on in, Brazil is just going to be a mainstay or a main sort of inclusion, not to be pandery, but also because it has historical legitimate weight. I'm interested to hear or know if developers on the team actually believe that or think that.
Yeah, I have a feeling it'll be Civ 7 rolls around, Brazil won't be in the main lineup. They'll move on.
Mongols, you can scratch anything if you feel like
it. Yeah. Although it was a free DLC up front, so...
That's true. It was basically a mainline Civ.
Basically.
Yeah. So it was like
Day Zero
DLC,
yeah.
Day Zero free DLC. Like,
that too,
okay.
Yeah.
Like, no doubt, Firaxis are very happy with the lineup they have, and obviously they have plans that we can't see unless we spot them in the background of a GameSpot video. I can't believe that actually happened, though. That definitely happened. But I feel like there's something that we don't know. Their focus on true start locations... It does sound, whenever they speak in public, that they sound like what they're doing is completely justifiable. Mm. And the thing is, I'm not sure if I actually understand how much the community really, really cares about civilizations and what civilizations get in and out. Because, yeah, honestly, playing as individual civilization and having these grandiose leaders and stuff like that, these are the hooks that get people into your game.
Well, it also helps if there's a sufficient amount of historical background for the dev, because then they can pick and choose.
Yeah, it was hard to design. Like, this actually really, it's really difficult to find what to do for Australia. And I struggled for a long time. Literally, the Prime Minister was one of our unique units, mainly because I can get a great quote in the game by Tony Abbott, which was literally nothing. It was because a great quote was ... You're not saying anything, Tony. ...
Maybe as a final point on this, I mean, we could have a whole episode about this particular topic.
Yeah.
I know some people have said to me, so, Dan, what do you think about Canada still not being a Civ? My default answer has always been, you've looked at the modding community, right? But as an official Civ, look, first we had Brazil in an expansion pack for Civilization V. Now, as DLC, we have Australia. So if there can be Brazil and there can be Australia, then there is hope. There is always hope.
And I hope that they leave it out permanently.
The thing is, Matt, you know that I am going to personally push for Canada.
Yeah, but me being Canadian, I actually don't really want their take on Canada, because, frankly, a lot of it is bullshit.
Yeah, Americanism. No, absolutely. That's why I tried to
really
push Australia in a direction.
I really don't want the bullshit Americanism take on Canada, because Americans, more than anybody else on the planet, know nothing about Canada in general.
If we're talking about reading between the lines, Australia was released at the same time as a modding update. Australia being one of the most popular mods. Oh, I just spelled it out for you when you didn't need to have it spelled out. All right, move on.
There you go.
I will say, in response to Matt's comment, given that Firaxis has now done both Brazil and Australia, given how well they have done with Australia, and I'm not talking about the Civilpedia text about the Civ, I'm talking about the abilities that we see in-game, I would be interested to see what Firaxis' take on Canada would be, but also recognizing that that will not be the only take. When to stop taking cities? Macedon? Well, definitely never, but what about not Macedon?
Yeah, probably never for Macedon. Yeah, this was an interesting thread. It wasn't all that long of a thread, but it hit everything that you'd be thinking about as you're doing this. One is the momentum around just continuing to take cities, because there, for the most part, really aren't any penalties to wide play, and one of the best ways to play wide is to take the other guy's stuff. You know, amenities are easy enough to manage. My read on all this is you stop taking cities when taking cities is a distraction from the victory condition you're otherwise focused on, and that's more a matter of your attention span than it is, and maybe diversion of resources. And as long as you're a successful acquirer, conqueror, the other guy has to worry about war weariness far more than you do. And right now, there's a little, I don't know if it'll get patched or if it's working as designed, but the notion that all you have to do is return one crap city clears off the minus 18 penalty with that Civ that's beneficial. there was also a lot of discussion in the thread of, you know, when you give back the city, if you're going to do that, you know, how do you make it as worthless as possible to the AI? And then my favorite thing was, I guess CLL3 hosted a marathon turn 700 or whatever map. It was an inland sea map, and it is just smothered with cities. It was just hilarious to look at.
What stuck out with me on that was, number one, nearing six-sided trade routes, and also about 8 minutes between turns.
Yeah, 575 trade routes, which it must be maddening to renew those, and then 8 minutes per turn. I mean, he must be getting a lot of stray reading done between turns.
I don't know how anyone can stomach playing that. That's impressive, though.
He was multitasking. He was watching a movie or some television show at the same time. But from getting fat further to this, he says, you know, if you also forward settle on the AI on the cities that you are taking, and then you return it to them, those tiles can be yours now, and they don't have as many tiles, and the population has also been reduced. So their ability to do anything with that city has been minimized as well. In addition to minimizing your warmongering penalty, you're also crippling that civ, and they're going to be happy with you returning to them what is now a considerably less effective city than they had initially, which is delicious. Now, this probably wouldn't work with a human, but certainly with the AI, they'll love you for it. But I think your point, David, about, you know, you stop constructing cities when it's becoming a distraction to whatever your victory condition is, it's similar to, we're going to be talking about this a little bit in the next topic. You know, when do you stop settling cities, or when do you decide I'm going to settle this less than ideal terrain? It's what is it that you are looking to do, and is that city going to be helpful? And I think sometimes taking a city might mean it's not going to be helpful to me, but it might be helpful to the AI. So, especially if you don't care about warmonger panels, I'm just going to go in and raise it.
Yep. Or if you're able to tile swap, pillage everything else, and seize all the bonus resources and make it a much less useful city, that may make sense as well, so that you still return it, but it's a shadow of its former self.
Recorded for episode 284 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and Canuck Soldier. Occupation Force from UW Habs. One thing that's bugged me for multiple Civ games is how easy opponents will roll over for you, especially in 6.
What?
Cities are almost fully usable once you capture them and become essentially fully yours when you sign a peace deal.
Wait, what?
Always feels to me that it should be much longer before you get a workable city out.
I wrote this down already.
I wrote this down based on wrong information.
That too, but I wrote this down from a design principle concept as well. Striking incentive to conquer people, and if you make it take much longer for a conquered city to be useful, that's exactly what you're doing. This does not have a good effect on the game. Punishing people for conquest is not, for successfully conquering their enemies, is not good times.
The penalty for conquering is you already in-game right now. It's occupied, and you get crap out of it until you convince the other person to give you the city. That's your penalty. And it gets more war weariness, so it could rebel faster.
Which the game has no way of compelling people to agree to, by the way, which I think is questionable. But
actually, I think there's a bug in there, because apparently when you make peace, you no longer have to actually see the city to get occupied, which is wrong. That would be a bug, because the whole point is until you get somebody to cede it, it's considered occupied. Period.
Yeah, unless you wipe them out completely.
Yeah, in which case, well, yeah, too bad. But for all other situations where you're not wiping them out, you're not supposed to gain the city free and clear until you cede. Now, granted, the AI will gladly cede all cities taken way too easily, so it kind of defeats the point. But
at the same time, the cede option itself, like, you need a way to compel it. That's by design. It's more costly than just taking the city. But it's possible to compel them to take that term, because right now, nothing's stopping someone from just refusing to ever give you crap.
Yeah, except if they're already losing cities, then you just run them over and then you get nothing.
Well, yeah, but they're going
to... That pushes it to another extreme where you have to wipe somebody out.
Yeah.
And if you're already taking cities, then likelihood that you will wipe them out.
If you're on the offensive, you're not going
to
stop.
Well, that's what warrioriness is supposed to do. Where it builds up
in principle
much faster in the cities you're taking.
That's what it's supposed to do, yeah.
In principle, true.
Well, and there's also issues with, if, you know, rebels end up spawning, the rebels are not of a particular concern.
Well, especially when you get later game and it's a joke.
Yeah, but here UW Habs wants to add the notion that not only could the city rebel, but a district could rebel of the city that you've just captured. So, quote, if a district rebels, then whoever you capture that city from gets a new melee unit on the district tile, and the district gets auto-pillaged. So I can just imagine that, hey, I've got a new melee unit, so, and now all the other hexes around it are you as the conqueror civ, and there's this one little district that's got this one little melee unit, and it's surrounded by your other units, seeing as how you're on the conquest path. It's not particularly concerning. Yeah.
Also, hi, we're going to rebel. We're going to be partisans who rebel to defend our land versus an occupier. I know. Let's burn everything down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, if it happens to be the city center that rebels, and the city actually flips back to them, it says, so if you capture a city at size 10 with four districts, you need to basically garrison four troops in the city for the next 10 turns to prevent any rebels from forming. Wait, garrison four troops in the city. Are we back to stacks?
I think he means a troop per district, maybe.
Oh, four troops.
But one unit on each district?
Not in the city center, the hex itself.
Oh, I'd hope not. That would be weird.
Once the resistance period is over, then the city gets an occupation counter. Say that counter starts at 100. Ooh, nice round number. Okay, so when this happens, if the counter is greater than zero, then the city gets 50% food and 50% production. The other yields are reduced by the occupation counter. So if the counter is at 75, then you get a minus 75%, and he does put in quotation marks, bonus, to those yields. The counter will naturally decrease every turn. It can decrease faster by stationing military units or by having a large cultural or religious influence on the city. As long as the occupation counter is greater than zero, there should be a chance that a district could rebel. However, in this case, it would simply just get pillaged and not spawn the units. It does feel like it's kind of already been said here that we're trying to have something reflected in the game that has already been reflected, at least as in principle, as Phil said. War weariness, number one. And then the rebels, if the rebel mechanic was a little more purposeful, if and when it actually spawns, that would do things better in terms of an occupation force and a resistance to the occupation, the ones being proposed here, I think. I certainly understand trying to have it so that, okay, you've taken over a city, particularly if it's a larger city, and not everyone is just going to say, oh, okay, you know, we welcome our new overlords. Fine, we want resistance built in. But I think what's being talked about here is just going down a garden path that, in addition to being complicated, seems kind of counterintuitive, and we just need to improve the mechanic that's already supposed to be dealing with this. Already been alluded to. Threads started by Artifacts 1. Settle large swaths of tundra or not? And specifically, he's asking, do you settle large swaths of tundra if it's in the back of your empire, vacant, or ignore it? Like enough for several cities, or you just maybe post a few troops there and ignore it for the rest of the game? And of course, the requisite, well, if I'm Russia, of course I'm settling it. And I think, well, are you going for the score for the territory? Because whether I'm playing Russia or not, it's what are you going to be able to do with that? And I think is well pointed out by Shakhan, as long as you can get that city to a size 4, then it can be helpful, because what it'll allow you to do is construct a few districts, so say a commercial hub, and maybe an industrial zone, and you're also going to get another trade route that you're going to be able to make use of as a result of the commercial hub coming online. And it's only going to take up one amenity as well. So it's kind of one of those, is it beneficial to settle that? It's probably going to be the last thing that you do. Some people suggest I'm going to settle part of the empire, you know, right at the edge of my empire to try to avoid somebody from settling near it. Or this territory could be mine, but someone's going to settle there and you don't want them to have a particular front for you in order to be able to land units, for example, then you go and settle it. So generally speaking, for me, I'm not settling for settling's sake, because no, maybe I don't want to spend the production on a settler or the goal on a settler to go and settle there. If I come across an AI that I'm fighting, who of course, you know, loves to build settlers when they're being captured, well, I'll just go and take that settler and I'll go and settle it. It's kind of a bit of an opportunity cost that I didn't have to take because they constructed the settler for me. As long as there is the ability to get some kind of decent district base to get up, has been suggested, to size 4. And so you've got that, and you can get the commercial hub buildings, and you can get the additional trade route, then it's going to be paying for itself. I guess the other part to note is, how quickly are you going to be winning the game? If you're going to be winning, and that will spend on game speed, but, you know, in the next 10 or 20 turns, probably not worth the while. But if you think it's going to take you more than that, then, yeah, it can certainly be part of your strategy.
Well, we've already talked about one sieve that definitely shouldn't do it, and that's Sumeria. Just camp out there and let the barbs spawn and clear them and get your tribal villages and rinse and repeat.
And then still with cities, and we actually kind of alluded to this already in terms of food output, with inevitable comparisons to Civilization V and possibly Civilization IV as well.
Started by my clan in the forums. Well, they got to replaceable parts. They would build a lot of farms to get the, quote, feudalism bonus, get their city housing up, grow the cities faster. But there's a certain point where you kind of want to stop growing. What do you do with the extra farms then? Replaceable parts gives you more food to the farms, therefore you don't need as many farms. So now what? Just leave them? You replace them? I mean, some people suggest if it was next to a river, you could do a forest lumber mill combo.
How much extra builder charges do you have to, like, how much marginal value are you getting switching it? Because if you get decent marginal value, if you're really trying to optimize cities, you might change some of them to something else, depending on what's available. But otherwise, just leave them. It'll provide a little bit of housing and just whatever.
I didn't see much other suggestions other than that one. I mean, specific suggestions. They've gotten more of general city layouts and things like that in the threads.
Well, what's available to you will depend on the civ you are and what's near the farms and what you can build instead of farms, what kind of alternatives you have. So it's not like you can just always be like, oh yeah, just replace the farm with a workshop later on and you'll be fine. It just depends. There you go. Plant forests and make a lumber mill. There you go. Okay, enjoy. Okay. Have your little bit extra production or 2 builder charges.
Well, considering how much the space victory is, that might help.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, although you only need a few cities for hammering out the space parts.
Yeah, I can see very limited situations in the game where it's, you know, I really want to put an industrial zone here, or, hey, I want to put a spaceport here, and there's already a farm there. Okay, you know, you go ahead and you change that, but to change it with a builder, with the limited builder charges, was already being said, you're probably better off sending that builder to another city or improving a hex that isn't already improved, or maybe you want to replace a farm because you don't need it for the food now, and now you want it for the wonder. It certainly doesn't hurt, as has been said, there for the extra housing. But even if you don't need the extra housing, it's not a negative that it's still there. You got the use out of it, and doesn't mean that you have to work it anymore. If you want to work something else, you want to run a specialist instead of working that tile, that's fine. You can just ignore it. Otherwise, it can just sit there and look pretty. It's not going to harm you in any way.
Pretty much, it's just opportunity cost, and very often, it's not worth switching out.
I think perhaps to summarize this, as from Dankt in the thread, try to keep a huge farmland between 2 or more cities for maximized farming efficiency so the rest of the population can work either other tile improvements or in the district.
Yeah, well, you know, the important point about that is farms that belong to other cities can contribute to the adjacency bonus for each city, so.
If you're on an overlap, you can grow cities with the farms you were using for the first cities as well. If we're talking about the scenario this person's asking, where most of your cities are probably pretty well developed by this stage in the game.
Yeah, as Shaka Khan points out, in Civ 6, production and gold, with faith as an honorable mention, are the king yields that will get you stuff that helps you win. It's much more important to get your builds done a few turns quicker than it is to grow a few turns quicker, especially since the critical mass for cities and wide empires is 8 or 10 for most strategies.
8 or 10? Why 8? Isn't 7 the third district?
Well, there's both districts and there's amenities. So when you hit 11, you need another amenity. So you stop at 10 is the theory.
Oh, I see.
10 also gets you with districts. So.
Yeah. I think the districts are more of a constraint than the amenities, typically. But that's true.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
This has been episode 286 of Polycast. We were joined by the usual folks, Mackie.
Cookies and coffee.
Mean tea.
My warmongering has infinite stamina and never gets exhausted.
Except in Russia in the winter.
Thank you.
What about coffee on cookies?
And of course we got joined by Brad.
Hey, this was fun.
Now see, the trick is you dunk the cookie in the coffee.
Yeah, you're not supposed to dunk the coffee in the cookie. Unless it's a really big cookie.
That would be a very big cookie.
Well, what if the cookie absorbed all of the coffee goodness?
That'd still be a very big cookie. Why am I eating a cookie that's the size of my head?
Isn't that why you would be eating the cookie? It's because it's the size of your head?
Oh, that's too much cookie at once.
No one said you had to have it all in one sitting.
It gets stale before you could get through a cookie that was the size of my head.
Well, maybe you want to share some with a friend.
Maybe before you could.
Yeah. Okay, if I eat nothing but cookie all day, then maybe
that
I
would,
get through it.
That would get me sick as well, though.
So. Yeah.
I can eat half a watermelon, but I wouldn't want to eat a watermelon-sized cookie. Like, tens of thousands of calories.
It'd be your entire calorie input for the week.
Yeah. Not to mention very little nutritional value in...
Get your carbs in, her.
And then some.
You'd really get your carbs in if you had a cookie the size of a watermelon. That'd be a lot of filling as well.
Yeah.
So next, let's see if we can find a watermelon the size of a cookie.
And if you can't, then make one yourself.
Bye, everybody.
Wow, Mackie's Skype status is available. I don't think I've seen that in 11 years. It's always do not disturb. What's going on?
Yep.
So she's putting up groceries.
Not putting them away, putting them up.
Wait, isn't she supposed to do groceries after?
During.
If you're putting up groceries, does that mean she's letting groceries move in? She's putting them up in her house?
No, she's basically moving them higher than their previous state, adding to their potential energy.
Oh, I see. So does that a permanent, or is she just like throwing them up in the air or something?
Well, adding to the energy probably makes them more nutritious somehow.
Raising their elevation makes them more nutritious?
Well, it takes more effort to get them, see? So you burn a little bit of extra energy just to get the food.
Yeah, that's right. They become slightly more calorie efficient. Use of like tossing them in the air and then catching them. If you do that for long enough, you'll get pretty tired depending on what you're throwing.
Grocery juggling. It's a new act.
Grocery juggle. Every time you buy something, you have to juggle it. You have to juggle it for the length of time it takes to burn all the calories from eating it.
Man, it's stuff like donuts would just be impossible. It'd be a good donut. You could buy it. It would take you so long to juggle to burn the calories involved. It just wouldn't be worth.
See? It's a great diet.
Because by the time you sufficiently juggled it to burn off the calories, it would be stale and you don't want it anyway, so you just throw it out and you don't have the calories to begin with. It's great.
So like, what would you eat? You'd eat things that are really heavy, like watermelons that don't have a lot of calories, and like meats, and then...
Well, I guess it depends on how good of a juggle you are.
And then still with cities, and we actually kind of alluded to this already in terms of food output, with inevitable comparisons to Civilization V and possibly Civilization IV as well. That's you, Mackie.
It's you, Mackie.
It helps if I unmute.
You can choose to talk and stay unmute, but that's going to be problematic for the rest of us, that's true.
They should put quotations on playable for multiplayer on huge maps. Go ahead. Show me an MP game that gets completed on that within, like, 2 months. Go ahead.
If you have the opportunity to build your farms...
Yes, Mackie fan, thank you.
Yes, exactly.
Well, speaking of whining...
Get out.
Okay, bye.
I'm not keeping his contractual obligations.
Actually, no, Matt was keeping to his contractual obligations. I was expecting him to say that.
All right.
See? It works.
Hello.
She was lifting weights just then, but not the kind made of metal.
No, the kind made of food bags.
Pre-live stream conversation in relation to your message there, Mackie, which may or may not be released in the future, which may or may not make this comment relevant. All right, so continue.
Well, thanks for the lack of information.
Record date?
July 22nd, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.